This is Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal for October 26th, 2017. This is Meredith DeFrancesco. Today we speak with Maine nurse Amy Lee Tidd, who just returned from a delegation to Puerto Rico, where the majority of residents suffer from a lack of potable water, food, safe housing, and the electricity needed to power life-saving medical equipment. And we look at Nestle's commodification of Maine's water with community water justice activist Nikki Sequeira. Today we're speaking with Amy Lee Tidd, a registered nurse from Bangor, Maine. She's just returned from 2 weeks in Puerto Rico as part of a delegation of 50 volunteer registered nurses organized by National Nurses United as part of the Registered Nurse Response Network. Welcome to the program, Amy Lee Tidd.
Thank you so much.
Today we want to talk about the conditions the people of Puerto Rico continue to endure and the serious health crisis that could intensify with the lack of clean drinking water, lack of food, the advent of mold in housing or lack of housing, and lack of electricity, particularly for medical needs. In a statement the National Nurses United put out says that your delegation encountered many residents that had yet to receive any aid by the U.S. government's relief efforts, and were told that your delegation was the first to offer any assistance. Today, the Registered Nurses Response Network is holding a press conference with members of Congress to call for additional assistance to Puerto Rico. Amy Lee Tidd, today we want to hear about the experiences of your health delegation with the people of Puerto Rico, the lack of mobilized assistance by the U.S. government, and then further examine from your perspective some other issues you've been looking at, the bigger picture of how austerity policies that have contributed to the lack of infrastructure and public funding availability has further exacerbated the disaster Puerto Rico is experiencing. But first, tell us about your delegation, its mission, and then what you experienced when you arrived.
Sure. So I'm, as you said, with Registered Nurse Response Network, which is a disaster relief program sponsored by National Nurses United. We're the largest U.S. union of RNs, and we were in Puerto Rico as part of a 300-member deployment, actually, led by the AFL-CIO, the National AFL-CIO, in conjunction with the Puerto Rican Federation of Labor, and the San Juan Mayor's Office was also hosting us. Mm-hmm. As you said, when we got there, we started out thinking we were probably on a purely medical mission, but it quickly became apparent that people were without basic needs, food, water, electricity, people without roofs. On our very first mission, we saw people standing in line for hours in the blistering heat, waiting for water and food. I believe it was the Red Cross. We did spot them giving out food and water in downtown San Juan. But as we went out further into some of the other neighborhoods, we were actually the first people that they had seen. San Juan itself, even. In some of the neighborhoods, they hadn't seen anybody offering food or water. And so it obviously complicates things when there is a lack of communication and a lack of ability to reach people via media or cell phones. So that definitely complicated things quite a bit. And these residents are continuing to live in houses with the roofs blown off, soaked interiors. We saw black mold everywhere. And it was immediately apparent upon entering residences because you could smell it and see it. So we started within San Juan and kind of moved our way out into some of the other municipalities. And the further we went, the worse it got, really, because in addition to the same types of conditions that we saw in San Juan, the communities were much more remote, so even if you do have a vehicle, it can take hours to get to an urban center where you could potentially find aid. And again, you're still looking at waiting hours in line and gas was being rationed. So that was always a concern to be able to get there and back. We did hear of an outbreak of leptospirosis while we were down there. I believe the death count unofficially is at 4. We won't have confirmation of that until the lab tests come back. But we also have heard of 76 other cases, people becoming ill. And that's a waterborne illness that comes from animal urine. And so none of the groundwater is considered clean in Puerto Rico right now. So that became our number one concern, was to educate people on how to treat the water that they were getting from other sources to keep it as safe as possible.
And talk about that lack of clean drinking water, how many people are being affected, and where are there any clean water sources that are being provided by any relief efforts?
We actually were providing bottled water as much as we could, although we found it extremely difficult to find it in stores. So when we could find it, we would buy it and give it out. But on some missions, we were finding we were going to, you know, store after store, and the water either wasn't available to buy or it was also being rationed, so only so many cases per family. And in some cases, they would allow us to buy more because of the mission that we were on, but still really never enough to give out to entire communities where we went. And so we've heard of other agencies giving out water, but unfortunately, all of the folks that we visited said that we were the first people to come.
Again, we're speaking with Amy Lee Tidd, a registered nurse from Bangor, Maine. She has just returned from 2 weeks in Puerto Rico as part of a delegation of volunteer registered nurses organized by National Nurses United as part of the Registered Nurse Response Network. So primarily, was your experience that communities were getting drinking water, from, as you said, from natural sources and rather than any sort of well sources?
Absolutely. We pulled over on the roadside a lot because we would spot people getting water out of drainage pipes or just from mountain streams. And so we would try to provide education there about treating the water with bleach. And bleach was also another really hot commodity down there. We provided bleach whenever we could, but that was also very difficult to come by and was being limited as far as the amount that you could get at once. So we actually split the bleach up into smaller containers and gave it out to as many people as we could.
Is iodine also something that's used?
Iodine is sometimes used, but unless it is the only ingredient, we have been told to recommend bleach.
So you said that a big part of your delegation then was trying to educate people about decontaminating water and what the risks of drinking contaminated water could be. Was that one of your main concentrations? And if you could also talk, I know you used community radio while you were down there to convey messages about contaminated water.
That was definitely our number one concern, was the water, because we're very concerned that there are outbreaks of other diseases coming. And if, you know, the risk isn't mitigated soon, then we're going to be looking at, you know, a whole secondary disaster. So we went to a neighborhood in Humacao on one of our missions, and somebody in our group had a contact with one of the local radio stations, and they were actually able to broadcast that we were going to be in the area, which was very helpful, because otherwise all we really had was somebody who knew somebody that knew somebody, and we would try and get these contacts in these remote villages to make our missions as successful as possible, because otherwise we were looking at going door to door. And so on that mission in particular, we were able to get the word out to an entire community and get the work done faster. We did have bottled water with us that day, as well as enough food to feed about 200 families in the area. And as they went through this sort of makeshift grocery line that we had set up, at the end, one of our Spanish-speaking nurses gave education about how to treat the water.
And talk about the lack of food.
The food is another issue. So in some stores you go to, there are adequate supplies. In other stores, the shelves are absolutely bare. So that was another thing we heard from people, is that nobody had been through with food either. So, and the food that they had received, the few people that we talked to that actually stood in the lines for FEMA for, you know, upwards of a day or more, was that they would get to the front of the line, and what they were actually given was an application or information on how to fill out an application for FEMA aid, and one single bottle of water, like a single serving, and a snack size bag of Cheez-Its.
So Cheez-Its.
Not food that would sustain anybody and their family. Oh. So we tried to give out comfort food, traditional food, whenever we could. So rice, beans, tomato sauce, traditional seasonings, matches, to make the little makeshift, you know, cook area outside with rocks. And that was very comforting to folks. We had... every time we went anywhere, people were in tears. They were just so thankful to see people and to know that they had not been forgotten.
What did you hear from people about their take on the lack of relief by the U.S. government?
We just had a lot of people asking us if we were FEMA. And, of course, to that we answered, no, we're not with FEMA. We're, you know, with our own independent organization. And what we heard is that they just hadn't seen anybody. And so, of course, without any communication, any internet, no media, they don't know what is really going on either. So, again, what we heard over and over again is that they just hadn't seen anybody. In that village that I told you about in Umacao, one of the men that I talked to was in tears because he said, we see the helicopters flying over every day, but they don't stop. They just pass us by. And so, again, they were so happy that somebody knew that they were there.
What is your take personally as being a part of a delegation that was able to go in and bring medical and food and water relief, but although in a limited way, given what your organization's own resources are, but compare or any comments you would have on what you feel the U.S. response could have been, should have been, should still be?
I would just echo a statement made by one of my fellow nurses, Kathy Kennedy, who was one of the leaders of the mission that we were on, that it's just unconscionable that the people of Puerto Rico are being left to die. We witnessed a humanitarian and healthcare crisis, and we know our government has the power to bring relief to those who are suffering. We're the wealthiest nation in the world, and you know there are many other issues at hand. You know, due to the Jones Act, they actually can't get direct relief from any other countries because all of the ships that are bringing supplies first have to go to the United States on the mainland and then be deployed out to Puerto Rico. So they don't actually, they have U.S. citizenship, but they are denied a lot of the rights that other U.S. citizens have.
Let's talk a little bit about something we spoke about before we went on the air, and that was the austerity policies that Puerto Rico has endured and the effects on public funding that has come from debt restructuring. Can you talk with us about that whole background that exacerbated and is continuing to affect this disaster that's already...
Sure. So the Electric Authority in Puerto Rico, or PREPA as it's known in English, became bankrupt several years before Maria hit, and in response to that, some austerity policies were issued, and as a way of debt repayment, rollbacks to public services and maintenance were what happened. And so that's things like pruning trees, waste collection, and other things that actually contributed during the storm to the power being knocked out more frequently and to a greater degree. And so we see this a lot all around the world. You know, public utilities are labeled as inefficient or ineffective, and then it's insisted upon that, you know, they form public-private partnerships, which is essentially outsourcing government services to private contracts for profit, which is actually why we're so concerned about this deal that has happened between the electric company in Montana for $300 million, the no-bid process. So that's very concerning.
And again, to define what an austerity policy is, at least with other countries, there are stipulations put on a borrower that they have to cut back on social spending in order to be given any sort of financial aid.
So as we saw, the aid package that was actually offered to Puerto Rico was not offered as complete aid, but as a loan. And so, as you said, loans often come with stipulations that defund public services.
Again, we're speaking with Amy Lee Tidd, a registered nurse from Bangor, Maine. She has just returned from 2 weeks in Puerto Rico as part of a delegation of volunteer registered nurses organized by National Nurses United as part of the Registered Nurse Response Network. So talk with us a little more about the actual day-to-day work that you did in the delegation, and particularly concerning medical needs and your concerns for a continuing crisis.
In addition to the lack of water and food that we saw, we also saw many folks with chronic health conditions and running low on their medications that didn't necessarily have any access to a pharmacy. So we saw a lot of folks with congestive heart failure, diabetes, without adequate places to store their insulin, and running low on blood pressure medications, diuretics, which are fluid pills that reduce the burden on folks with congestive heart failure. So these are things that are chronic conditions that are easily managed when you have access to healthcare resources, but can become deadly problems in the event that you're not actually able to get those resources.
And what was your experience or knowledge while you were there of the experiences of hospitals regarding electricity? Were most hospitals online or had generators, or how? I'm thinking about patients who need medical devices to survive.
Some hospitals had backup generator power, but it was not consistent. So we actually were woken up one morning at around 2 o'clock in the morning because a local hospital had lost power, and they needed doctors and nurses to aid in the critical care transport because people were needing to be manually ventilated. A lot of folks rely on power to run things like their ventilator equipment. People that don't otherwise have airways of their own. So that is a major issue happening in Puerto Rico right now, is that there is no consistent source of power for a lot of these places. And we're being told that, you know, we had several nurses actually go to the hospitals, and the ratios are just astronomical of patients to nurse and doctors. So we're not sure that people are getting the care that they need while they're in the hospital. And folks that don't have access to even get to the hospital, we just don't know quite the full extent of what's actually happening. We've been told by folks in many of the places that we've gone that there have been a lot more deaths than what have been reported. But people aren't just waiting around for someone to come get their dead. They're actually being buried in the community itself. So I think it'll be a long time before we'll actually know the full effects of this crisis on the healthcare system, as well as what the actual death toll is.
So, but your impression is because of the lack of electricity, there's been an increase of deaths in hospitals.
Absolutely. We've heard news that while we were down there that the morgues were at capacity. We don't actually know what the count was prior to the storm, so again, it's impossible to know the actual numbers. But it's not a situation that you would expect to run into on a regular basis in an American hospital.
Amy Lee Tidd, coming back from this delegation, what is the message that you would bring, that you would like to express either to the general public or to the U.S. government?
My number one thing that I would want to express is that Puerto Rico still needs help. They need more help. And what they do not need is a loan package that will send their electricity and healthcare services, further into crisis.
Anything else that you'd like to add about your experience there, about future delegations that you might know about that is going down, if people want to contribute to help with any of the aid measures?
That's actually a very interesting question. One of the biggest ways that we were able to do the work that we could do down there was because of a GoFundMe account that one of my team members had set up. So I guess my number one recommendation is to find a way to give direct aid to folks that are actually there. GoFundMe is actually kind of partitioned off a whole section of just pages to give aid to Puerto Rico, as well as having seen the American Red Cross on the ground doing work. I think that's probably a great organization to go with. But I think the number one pressure needs to be put on the federal government to aid this territory, as is their responsibility.
And anything you'd like to add about your concerns for the future with climate change bringing on ever-increasing, intensifying storms and so-called natural disasters?
Absolutely. Nurses are scientists, and in general, we believe that the climate change crisis is real, and we will continue to see this scale of natural disaster. And it absolutely needs a huge response from the federal government to curb what is ahead, so that these things don't keep happening.
And in closing, is there anything else you'd like to share from what you heard from people there experiencing this reality day to day? We hear about stories of people having to help each other and that incredible effort of neighbors helping neighbors, but at some point supplies run out for everybody. But is there any message that you heard that you would like to communicate from those you were working with?
Just that they want folks to know that they're still there, and a lot of these folks are not going to be leaving the island, so they still need help. They need your support, and they need your pressure on your legislators to make the aid a reality.
Amy Lee Tidd, we thank you very much for joining us on the program today.
All right, thank you.
Again, that was Amy Lee Todd, a registered nurse from Bangor, Maine, who has just returned from 2 weeks in Puerto Rico as part of a delegation organized by National Nurses United, part of the Registered Nurse Response Network. We end with a brief excerpt today from a speech by Freiburg resident Nikki Sequeira with Community Water Justice. She spoke this summer at the Penobscot River Rally in Flotilla, which highlighted a number of water issues from across the state. We'll cover this topic in more depth in future programs.
The particular threat that I've been focusing on recently, in recent years, is the corporation Nestle. Most of us know them as Poland Springs, or as I refer to them, Stolen Springs. So we're in a competition for narrative in Maine. The corporate narrative is that Maine has plenty of water, and them bottling up some water and shipping it out of state is inconsequential, and it's good for Maine's state economy. The other narrative is, what will water displacement at the volume in which they're doing it, what type of impact will that have over the next decade, 20 years, 50, and 100 years? Right now, we are experiencing an extension of the colonization that's been happening since Columbus arrived. So right now, in rural communities, as in Freiburg, what we've been experiencing is a very powerful corporation coming in and engaging with small rural communities at the municipal level and manipulating conversation in executive sessions to communicate the pathway forward. Maine is a good place for Nestle to be because we do have antiquated groundwater protection laws called absolute dominion. But what Maine people don't realize is that absolute dominion encourages collectivism. And we do have laws that are there to protect us and allow us to push back from corporations as Nestle from exporting our water, but we need to better effectively use them. Maine is a home rule state, and we do have the ability to put in ordinances to block corporations as Nestle for taking our water for wholesale, bypassing benefit to the local environment and the community, and exporting it all over the country. Soon to be the world, we don't know where the market for Poland Spring will expand, but what we do know is in Canada recently, they've been signing contracts and negotiations to export their water to China. And so with the pipeline, the corridor, east-west corridor that's due to be built in our state, that could be Maine one day. So for a rural community, when we're thinking about resources that aren't water, yes, Nestle's market capitalization is at $239.6 billion, and they've been listed as the most profitable corporation on the planet. And right now, the water part of their sales is the fastest growing part of their company. And we have their takings here in Maine to thank for a lot of that. Right now, I want to mention a few towns that are currently fighting. They're becoming an increased risk to our area here on the Penobscot because they are going into the communities of Greenbush, Milford, Passadumkeag, and Lincoln. They already have test wells. They're already paved the way for their inevitability of going into these regions unless we push back now. They're also securing resources in Rumford, and they're looking to put their fourth bottling plant in either the Lincoln area, the Rumford area, or Freiburg, where I live. So they're setting up a scenario right now to get people on the ground to push for job opportunities. You know, a bottling plant can bring 40 jobs, maybe up to 80, but we need to think about the economic impact of what that will truly bring to our communities when we give up our water sovereignty to allow them to export our water. Well, that's a great question, and it depends on the community. From the community of Denmark, Maine, they pay nothing for the water. They pay taxes on the property and the infrastructure that they built in that community. In Freiburg, Maine, they pay 1/10 of 1 cent for the water. So one tanker is about 8,500 gallons. So what they're paying from Freiburg for a tanker that size is a little under $18. And if you're putting all of 8,500 gallons into 16-ounce bottles, the profit margin is anywhere between 1,000 and 2,000%. And we're not getting a return on that. I'm not for the commodification of water, but we are being ravaged. So, yeah.
Thank you, Nikki.
Again, that was Nikki Sakara with Community Water Justice. And you have been listening to Radioactive on WERU Community Radio. You can listen to archives of this and other locally produced public affairs programming at weru.org.